And good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name's Jim Hutchings, and again this week I'm joined by our co-host Mona Hill, and our friend Dave Cowley is our guest today. We want to bring attention to Black History Month with David, who was in attendance at the August 28, 1963 Civil Rights March on Washington by over 250,000 people. We're going to talk about his personal experience during those days in the Civil Rights Movement. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
That is incredible to actually have been basically a part of history.
Right. Well, you know, from the time I was quite young, I've been involved in a lot of movements and activities. Mm-hmm. Way back in when I lived in Michigan in Pontiac, Donna and I were protesting when the French were pulling out of Vietnam, and wow, the U.S. was threatening to come in. And, and I think I was 23 at the time, and I haven't gotten it out of my blood yet. But
So you mentioned Donna. Donna's your wife.
Yes.
Yeah. And so she's been right along with you all these years.
Oh, yes. That's
this.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go back a little and talk about, I mean, you are an American citizen. You were born in the States.
Right.
And When did all this start for you, your passion for civil rights and your passion for fighting for equality? It must have been before your 20s, obviously.
Yeah, well, probably heavily influenced by my father, you know, who was a teacher, but, you know, would invite the UAW into, you know, his classes.
United Auto Workers?
Yeah, United Auto Workers in Michigan and so forth. But I got my education, my master's degree in social work, and I was working for the welfare department in Detroit.
And what years would this have been?
That would have been 57, 58,
okay,
somewhere.
Okay.
And so one of my co-workers in welfare, I guess he got a job with the Detroit Commission on Community Relations, and I guess he could see that I was not a bigoted person, because I was working with a lot of black people in the welfare department. So he recommended me to be hired for the Detroit Commission on Community Relations. So I started out there as a case investigator, you know, looking into complaints of police brutality and housing discrimination and that sort of thing. And became vice, you know, chairman of the commission, or vice director, and worked there until 64, and then I would move to Ann Arbor, where I was director of the Ann Arbor Commission on Human Relations.
Okay. So in 1963, when you decided to go to Washington, would this have jeopardized your job at all, or would it have been encouraged that you be a part of that, or
would it have been encouraged, although, you know, as a professional, so to speak, in working for government, you know, the idea was the commissions were appointed by, say, the mayor of the city,
right,
and the concept was we'll include a broad range of people on the commission, and as a part of your program, you're trying to bring the commission along to, you know, that they can better understand the issues of racial discrimination,
right,
and the need to inclusion and so forth. And then they act as a buffer between you and the government, so that the programs that you try to initiate, you know, the mayor can't call you and say you're fired. It has to go through the commission, and the commission is there to support you in your efforts. So, you know, it's a very exciting process of working with people and having them. And we were able to get away with a lot of things. Say in Detroit when I was there, like the Federal Housing Administration kept a list of houses that have been repossessed. You know, they were the mortgage lenders people, the federal, and they would keep that list away from black people so that they could not see which houses were available. And so somehow or other, I've forgotten the dynamics, but we were aware of this one family who wanted to get this house out in the suburbs. And, you know, yes, of course, the real estate people and everything were against that. Well, we made sure that they got the house. But then we heard rumors that the neighborhood white citizens groups was organizing against it. So then I would do things like go secretly to their meetings to find out, you know,
what... You were a spy.
Yeah, I was a spy to find out what was up and so forth. And then, you know, we had a very good police chief at the time. He had been head of the Supreme Court and transferred over to be the police chief because it was such a critical, in Detroit, such a critical position. So we said, you know, we have to have round-the-clock protection on that house. And he agreed to it. But then the people who were assigned to it conveniently went for coffee at a time when the White Citizens Council came in and started the house on fire.
Very,
you know,
convenient.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So then we went out, our little team, to investigate. The police said it was an overheated furnace or something. So we went in and found this can of gas, you know, and unfortunately the house had been...
torched.
It had been put out before the house burned.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But then the family was determined that they moved in anyway, and you have to give them credit. So one of my jobs was to go out and sit with them at night, you know, to make sure that they were supported, you know. So.
Wow.
We have no idea today. Our young people today have no idea it was like.
Donna, my wife, is a member of a book club, and a member of her club came over yesterday, and we were sitting around having coffee. Well, one of the books they have is called, I think it's called Help. I guess it's a current book that a lot of people are reading, and it's about black help in the South, you know, and the white people, it portrays this business of these wealthy white people sitting around in their relationships with their maids.
Okay.
Well, you know, in the South, of course, during Jim Crow days, blacks couldn't go to a white washroom.
Right.
But what I didn't know until yesterday, and I should have known, is that if you were a maid in somebody's house, you could not use their bathroom.
Wow.
Can you imagine how degrading that would be? And so they would probably have some little biffy around and back.
An outhouse or something.
Yeah. And apparently in the book, the maids were, they were expected to thank them very much for having this little biffy in the back, you know, for them to use. So the degradation of things that were happening in the South and the North, too. I mean, it's just amazing that people closed their eyes to that kind of stuff.
And perpetuated it.
Yeah.
Yeah, either one or the other or both, right?
Yeah, right.
And you know, and some of our listeners know, that this is a very personal issue for me as well, because my children's father's ancestors were escaped slaves that came through the Underground Railway up into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very close to my heart, you know, that Southern racism and the slave era. And one of the things that a lot of listeners would be surprised to know is that slavery was not always illegal in Canada. You know, as far as Black History Month goes, this is something that a lot of people don't realize, that we seem to have this opinion of ourselves that we're so accepting. And we may be now to a certain degree, but we weren't always.
Well, a great book that was popular a couple of years ago is the Book of Negroes.
Yes, I've read that book.
Which is amazing in terms of the kind of discrimination that occurred in Canada.
Exactly,
But one of the things I want to emphasize, you know, about Martin Luther King, and partly I was not aware of it because Don and I and our family moved to Africa in 67 and worked with the Zambian government. And during that period, Martin Luther King shifted from being almost totally concerned with discrimination and desegregation, to realizing that poverty was a main part of the problem for blacks. And he was planning a mass demonstration in Washington, not just a speech, but to actually what he called bringing government to its knees, because he said the U.S. was, the government of the U.S. was some of the key, part of the key problem.
Right,
and
right.
Especially the war in Vietnam, he was totally, you know, against that, and
right.
said blacks were, you know, too much part of taking the burden for what was going on over there. But so there were programs at that time, and we were part of it. Like, I, in addition to being human relations director, I was also director of Ann Arbor's anti-poverty program for government funds, you know, that were coming in. And so we had a person on our staff who was like a big uncle, a big black guy, you know,
yeah.
with a very understanding, and he would, on his own, there would be programs for uplifting kids, you know, and literacy and so forth. He was living in Detroit at the time, and he would, you know, drive in early in the morning to go around and knock on these kids' doors to make sure they got up and got to their programs in time. And so, you know, there's a great deal of concern and realization that having employment and work and so forth was one of the key
right.
things to solving
right.
these problems.
Right. Well, some of the information I dug up was in regards to the development of the march was that there were various civil rights groups, there were labor organizations, religious bodies,
right.
sort of all came together, and the theme chosen, I guess, after a lot of meetings was probably called the march was Jobs and Freedom, as you mentioned it, you know, because that's sort of focuses on poverty, doesn't it, when
right.
you're talking about jobs, right? And there were other people involved besides Martin Luther King Jr. that most people don't know about, I think, unless they were there, and that was A. Philip Randolph, John Lewis, Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young, and Bayard Rustin. And it said, although these leaders of the march led from the front, they found themselves had some differences of opinion on the purpose of the march. For NAACP, National African American,
National Association for the
Advancement of Colored People.
Right.
Yes, and Urban League. This march was a gesture of support for the Civil Rights Bill introduced by the Kennedy administration, whereas the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Congress of Racial Equality saw this as a tool to condemn the inability of the Kennedy administration. So it seems that everyone had sort of their own agenda for being there. But despite that, everybody came together, and it was such an incredible success.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so a lot of people were involved in a lot of different organizations.
Yeah, but most of us, you know, we had our own professional organization of people working in the civil rights movement, and you know, we realized right from the beginning that if the federal government and the courts and police and so forth did not back what we were doing, that we were lost, especially
right.
in the South. You know, for the longest time, the FBI would sit on the sidelines and just watch everything. And so a lot of pressure began to be put on the federal government, you know, that if you're not down there to assure that people are not lynched and jailed for no good reason, you know, that mm-hmm. we're lost.
Right.
And one of the things that the federal government finally did was their program of contract compliance, which said if you have a contract with the federal government to produce military things or anything, you know, that you have to, you know, have an employment policy that shows that you've hired X number of black people.
Sort of an employment equity program.
Yeah,
eh?
And so even our little commission in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you know, some of my friends were working in contract compliance. So we would locate people in Ann Arbor who needed work, and we would refer them to, say, General Motors or Ford or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then he, in contract compliance, would go and see if these guys were hired, and if not, why. So we would work in conjunction, you know,
okay.
with each other.
Okay.
And then you know, I was in, I had friends in both the Wayne University and University of Michigan School of Social Work, and they would refer people to our agency as part of their educational, you know, background experience. And so one year we decided that one of the students would be in charge of seeing that there were black people included in the electrical workers union, you know, training, apprentice program.
Apprenticeship, right.
So, you know, we got a hold of the test that they needed in order to, you know, be accepted. Mm-hmm. And then we ran a little program so that they would, you know, be acquainted with the test. This was all legal. It was not under the table.
Yeah.
And so then they eventually hired, you know, black people. And we realized that that was an important part. You know, if blacks didn't have access to these kinds of things, mm-hmm. then, you know, we were lost. So.
Right.
That was a very subtle way of blocking them. Have these little tests. And I guess they did the same thing with voters lists and things like that.
Yeah, we had a whistleblower once, too, and there was this national organization that was a credit organization, or a lending organization, mm-hmm. I guess. And this person came in and said, well, here's this form. You see this form, and you see this little check mark here? That is to indicate race, you know, so that if this form goes to the office, that you don't have to wonder, you know, mm-hmm. whether they're black, and we don't.
That's very interesting. Yeah. You should raise that, because many, many, many years ago, I worked for a long-known Canadian corporation mm-hmm. when I was mm-hmm. a young woman. And I worked in the credit department.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer in existence, so maybe I could tell everybody it was Eaton's Canada. Because there's nobody around anymore. I worked for Eaton's Canada, and I worked in the credit department, and I took in the mail payments. People would send in mail with a check, you know, and we collected that, and we collated it all. And one of the things I discovered very quickly when I worked there, now this would have been back in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, and I discovered that there was a space on there to mark or make commentary by the credit employees who were offering people credit or accepting their application for credit as to whether or not they were Indian.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah. Right,
yes,
of course.
Which stunned the hell out of me.
Yeah, right.
And it angered me a lot. But it was very common for them to make comments about this person. Sounded Indian on the telephone. Therefore, no credit.
Right.
Yeah.
No, we had, I guess you would say, fun with this because we had no jurisdiction. I mean, we were in charge of the Fair Housing Ordinance, which we could have a hearing, you know, if there was discrimination in housing. But we had no authority over this credit kind of thing.
Right.
But we decided that we would have a public hearing anyway. And the head of the company flew in from Los Angeles, you know, to our hearing, which was in just a little office about the size of this. And so, you know, and the press was there, so they got huge exposure. Well, that's part of the game, is not just law enforcement, mm-hmm. but public exposure,
right.
You know. So obviously they changed their form. Whether they changed their practice is another question.
Yeah, but I was going to say, you know, in theory, this can work really well.
Yeah, right.
And go back to, you were talking about the contract compliance and the referrals, referring mm-hmm. black people to organizations to work, like GM or something like that. And I was thinking about the response once someone got there, a new worker got there, you know, and was hired because of the, you know, being sort of forced to by the contract compliance forms.
Yeah.
And but how were they responded to by their fellow white co-workers, and that was a hard time.
Yeah,
that
right.
was such a hard time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you can only go so far.
Yeah,
and then kind of people are kind of on their own, you know.
Yeah,
and I
right.
mean, that's what we look at today in terms of a human rights commission. Our human rights commissions are supposed to be there for those specific issues where mm-hmm. someone is feeling discriminated against in the workplace or in housing or in the healthcare system or mm-hmm. schooling, something like that. I guess that's sort of where it came out of.
Yeah. No, you sometimes wonder about families, you know, that are pioneers moving into white neighborhoods, you know.
And I know.
Their kids and everything, you know, the because there was so one of the things that I remember from the research in Martin Luther King's at one point he moved his family into the slums and ghettos of Chicago, just terrible circumstances, but he decided to, you know, it was worth it, and that if he didn't demonstrate his solidarity with those people, he would be lost. But then there was a parade into Cicero, you know, by blacks, and he said he never saw so much hate in his life, and this is a northern
directed
city.
At them in the north. It's interesting because my personal experience also goes back to having sisters-in-law who dated some of the guys. We came out of Winnipeg, right, and dated some of the guys from the Grand Forks Air Base who had come from the Deep South. And I was always of the assumption that, you know, we were fine up here and we treated everybody great, right? But I remember talking to some of those fellas from the air base at, you know, when they were in Winnipeg visiting, and having them say to me, we would rather live in the Deep South where we know we're hated than come here. This is a fact.
Right.
Then come here and have to guess if we're hated, because it's very underhanded. Don't think you guys aren't racist, they said to us, you know.
Oh,
but we know it's here. It's just really underhanded, and you pretend you're not. And I remember one in particular saying to me, well, when I walk down the street, I know somebody doesn't want to spend time with me because he crosses the street when we're the only ones there.
Here in Canada?
Here, no, this was in the Deep South. And they'd rather live there knowing what's expected of them rather than coming here and not knowing,
right?
You know, and then making a mistake and then having to deal with it because they've come in contact with the wrong person.
When I was in high school, there were four of us. We had an old beat up Ford, and we decided to go to Florida at Christmas time, and we got down as far as southern Georgia, and the car broke down, so we had to spend several days in town, and we, you know, got to know some local, of course, white people, and they took us out into the Okefenokee Swamp and got us some moonshine and so forth. But they had to show that they were true bigots, you know, and so they'd be walking down the street, and the old gentleman black person would be walking on the sidewalk, and they would make him get off the curb, you know, and that was their way of showing off. But,
and how did you and Donna deal with that, David? What would you have done?
What can you do?
You were their guests, right? Exactly.
Well, that wasn't Donna. That was just several of us guys.
A bunch of guys. Okay, I see.
Right.
Yeah. But, wow. Yeah. I went to school, university, after 2002 for my degree, and I went to class with a young man who had been in the Iraqi war, who had come out of Texas. Actually, it's originally California. His father is a radio announcer in California, and they had moved around a little bit when he was young. And they moved to Texas, and this fella told me they still have the signs on some of the gas station doors over the bathrooms. This is a few years ago. Some of those signs are still there in the rural areas where they have the white door and the Negro door. They've never taken the signs down.
Right.
Yeah. It just blew me away. Okay, we have 3 minutes of this half. another thing, let's get back a little bit to the reason for the march and what was going on too, David. What else I have here is that this A. Philip Randolph referred to the march as the advance guard of a mass moral revolution for jobs and freedom. We had talked about that. And he also expressed the demands by the protesters. Those demands that I have here were meaningful civil rights legislation, an end to school segregation. I don't know if you were involved in any of that at all with the school segregation. And a $2 minimum wage.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you something about the school. You know, Ann Arbor School, of course, had a reputation worldwide. You know, the University of Michigan is there, and it's a very middle-class community. So the Ann Arbor, you know, people were very proud of their Ann Arbor school system. Well, one of our students that I had, you know, from the university, decided on his own to call the Ann Arbor schools and pretend to be a person looking for, I guess, a secretary. Said, you know, I've just moved from Detroit and I'm opening a real estate office and I would like to have a secretary. you know, as part of your co-op training program to come and work at my office. But he said, you know, I'm new in town and I would prefer to have a white person, you know, secretary rather than black. Is that possible? Oh, yes. You know, there's no problem that way. Well, we had not authorized this, but the person decided on their own to do it. So once we had the information, we can't just throw it away.
Right.
So then there was another young student there, and she was pregnant and expecting a child. So she decided she would also call, and she said, well, you know, when I have my child, I would like a young girl to come and take care, you know, help me with housework and this, that, and the other. Can I have a white girl? You know, I don't. Can you assure me? Oh yeah, no problem.
Oh
no.
Yeah.
So the superintendent of the schools was a friend of the commission chairman, who was a minister, a very progressive minister, and. So we went to see him about this, and he was upset, but he shared this with the Board of Education, and there were some right-wing people on the board who brought it to the attention of the city council, and they wanted me fired for having done this kind
well,
of stuff.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions somewhere along the line is, have you ever felt danger? Have you ever felt you were in danger? Or, you
right.
know?
Right.
Yeah, I could see that.
Right.
Wow, absolutely.
Okay, we're going to take a break here
All
now.
All right, we're going to take a break.
And we'll be back after this, and I'm going to play some music, too.
Right.
Okay.
We'll be back with David Cowley, and we're celebrating Black History Month.
I'm too sure.
And we're back.
Yeah. Are we back?
We're back.
Oh, we're having conversation here. Welcome back, everybody. If you weren't here at the top of the show, I'm Mona Hill, and I'm here with Jim Hutchings, and we're on Human Rights Radio, and we are interviewing a good friend by the name of David Cowley, who has been in the forefront for many, many years, back from all the way back to the 1950s, of civil rights in the United States. And we're having a conversation about, oh, all that stuff, about civil rights, about discrimination and bigotry, and about David's life working for commissions in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I can't remember the name of the commission.
Well, in Detroit, it was the Detroit Commission on Community Relations, in right. Ann Arbor, Detroit Commission on Human Relations.
Right, so, right. Yeah. And David was actually present and counted for it, probably, in the 1963 March on Washington that was created by many different leaders and included Martin Luther King Jr. David was privy to the I Have a Dream speech. How did that affect you?
Well, you know, Martin Luther King obviously was a hero of us working in the field, and
yeah.
It was extremely inspiring, and especially being with all those people at the same time.
250,000, they
yeah,
say.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
you see pictures of it, it's just, you know, a number of people. It's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, we're going to hear some of that. Jim's edited some of that together.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so we found some of the original stuff on YouTube, and we're going to listen to it now.
Okay.
All right,
okay.
Here we go.
At this time, I have the honor to present to you the moral leader of our nation. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today that freedom ring, and if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. When we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, we'll be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah. I always cry when I hear that, so I'm trying to compose myself.
Right.
And wow. you were there, Dave.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Another trip that I took to Washington, this time with my son, when he was maybe 5 or 6 years old, and this was an anti-Vietnam War demonstration. And after the demonstration, we were in a bar, which obviously must have let kids in. And so Tom went to the washroom, and there was this guy in there saying, "What in the hell are you doing at a place like this? You know, your parents should have you kept you at home." And I wasn't there, of course, but he related to me how he had told this guy why he was there.
Yeah.
And did an amazing job, you know, in terms of, you know, at that age being able to say why he was
right,
there, you know.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
That puts me in mind of something else that I dug up. Was another reason for the march apparently was for protection for all civil rights protesters.
Mm.
And of course, we've seen a few movies that have been made, you know, through Hollywood. Was it Mississippi Burning, I believe?
Mm.
And,
right.
You know, and
right.
I mean, and today, Amnesty International, is in the forefront of trying to protect people who are protesting for other people's human rights, because they seem to be in as much danger just like they were back then.
Right.
And we talked a little bit. We touched on maybe you almost lost your job. Somebody was trying to, you know, cause you to lose your job because of the work that you were doing. Did you ever feel in any danger at any time?
Oh, yeah. You know, like part of our program, too, was to contact employers around and encourage them. We didn't have the right to enforce that kind of thing, but we would say, well, we can send you people and so forth. Well, there was a chain of restaurants that was theoretically or allegedly owned by the mafia, you know. So we would call them a number of times and put pressure on them. And I started getting death threats, you know, on the phone at night. Not specifically saying stop this kind of stuff, but you know, we sort of suspected where it was coming from.
Wow.
But the police department in Ann Arbor was, you know, under the same government as I was. And, you know, we didn't have that many complaints against the police department in terms of racial discrimination. For one thing, the black population of Ann Arbor was quite small.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently we'd done enough that the police, some police were not happy with us. And one day I came to work, and when I came out, my car was gone.
Oh.
So I was good friends with the city attorney. As a matter of fact, he later married Donna's sister, you know, so we were quite close. And so he found out that the police had picked up my car and taken it to the pond. And when we looked in, they said, well, you were in the wrong parking spot. Well, I'm sure I wasn't. I knew what my parking spot was.
Yeah.
So, you know, I said, well, look, I'm not going down and picking up my car. You took it down there so you can bring it back, you know. And so, I mean, you know, it was a sort of oftentimes a power game, you know.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah. So did he bring your car back?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
But another dramatic thing was one of our employees went to a bar in the downtown Ann Arbor that had this reputation of discriminating against black. He was black. And they end up, the police came, and he got beat up. And so it seemed as though nothing was going to happen. So we had a subcommittee of our commission interview him and go through a procedure where they were convinced that he had not gone there on purpose and that had not caused trouble. And but then the city administration appeared that they weren't going to do anything about it. And so a couple of our staff meetings persons went to the Democrats were in control of the city council at the time. So they had their caucus meeting on Sunday at somebody's house. And so this black assistant director and I went there, which we definitely were not supposed to do.
Oh, you weren't invited.
We weren't invited, so we went there and we said, if that cop is not fired, there's going to be shit happening in this town.
Yeah.
They didn't appreciate it, but they fired the guy.
And this was still in the 1960s, was it? Wow,
right.
That's very powerful.
Yeah. And you know what happened to him the next day, the cop? The sheriff department hired him.
Hired him.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So then he went from being a city police officer to a sheriff.
Sheriff, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
But there were some people who were not very happy at us for taking, you know, such a stand.
It's, I bet.
Yeah.
Wow. Apparently the march ended after Martin Luther's speech. After which the leaders of the march met with President Kennedy. It said the march was a huge success and it played an important role in the Constitution of Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a catalyst, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
That act banned racial discrimination in public facilities as well as voting. It was a demonstration of the power in a peaceful right. In fact, many historians even went to describe the march as a high tide phase of the civil rights movement. Would you feel the same way about that?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, from my point of view, you have to explore the circumstances of the 60s and why actually so many things did happen, positive things happened, you know, the change of voting practices and so forth. And a good part of it was the fact that the Soviet Union was confronting the U.S., not only in terms of the practices within the U.S., but in terms of colonialism. And they were projecting themselves as being great heroes of liberation and so forth.
Right, right.
Which, you know, a lot of us realize that they weren't sincere in that, but it was embarrassing the U.S. And as a matter of fact, Kennedy at one point called the civil rights people. He was on his way to Vienna to meet with Khrushchev. And the freedom rides were going on at that time. And he said, "This is embarrassing me in our relationship with them. Would you please call them off?" And of course, yeah. There says, "No way are we going to do that."
Wow.
But I think, you know, a good part of the reason why there was so much progress was because the U.S. realized that these practices were totally outmoded and, you know, not defensible.
Right.
And so it was much easier for us, because you could expose these awful practices and the rest of the world, and decent people in North America would say, "This has to stop."
Right.
You know.
Right.
So.
Sort of a matter of looking in your own backyard before you criticize anybody else.
Right.
Which is very similar to, for some of our listeners who had heard the portions that Jim edited together in the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech. It was a portion I wanted him to put in there because as I listened to it, I said to him, "What does this remind you of?" That it's very reminiscent of our First Nation people and breaking of the treaties and, mm-hmm. you know, and forcing them onto reserves and the poverty that they've lived in for so many years and the inaccessibility to education and good health care. For me, it wasn't much different when I was listening to that. And it's a matter of perhaps looking in our own backyard
mm-hmm.
when, before we start complaining about what other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to mention was that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, has an article, Section 1, Article 20, everyone has the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. And when I think about that march that you were involved in back in 1963 for civil rights, was it all peaceful? I mean, all the videos we see, everybody looks so peaceful and they're listening to the speakers and but were there any fights that broke out or did anyone feel any danger from the police? Was it surrounded by police to make sure? I'm sure there must have been thousands of police officers there. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, a lot of times it was turmoil, you know, and people running and people being chased.
Is that right? Because we don't see that on videos.
No.
Yeah.
And one personal experience, again, it has to do with the police. You know, it was part of my job as an observer in Ann Arbor when there was a demonstration to be there to try to ascertain, you know, what was going on and who was being, you know, unlawful or acting improperly or whatever. And so at one point when there was a lot of turmoil and I was down there and running to make sure that I could see what was going on, a policeman came up and hit me over the head with a billy club.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I know damn well he knew who I was.
Yeah. So there was some violence involved.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And, I mean, this brings us right to the summer where Jim and I were at the G20 in Toronto.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, if you're looking at the G20, how does that compare from what you could see of the reports on TV and maybe from what Mona and I have told you about what went on? You know, it's a smaller gathering. We had thousands of people there, but we didn't have tens of thousands of people.
Right.
How do you think it compared as far as like the way the police reacted to the crowds and that sort of thing?
Well, I think the police totally overreacted in Toronto. You know, I haven't followed it in great detail, but I think that things are changing in the sense that people are not as informed about, you know, what's happening in the third world and the fact that you know, the advanced countries in the world are not, you know, they're not allowing the products to come in, and the World Trade Organization works against the interest of underdeveloped countries, and I think we need to be much more aware of, you know, right, what's going on in the world, right, from a trade point of view.
And right. And it seems to me that it's going to have to be up to us individually to gain that awareness,
mm-hmm,
that we're not going to be able to count on our government,
right,
to do that, to educate us in that area. I don't know what they're learning about in school now. I mean, I haven't had kids in school for years. But, you know, I don't know the direction it's taking.
But there's a great movie that's available at the library called Life and Debt. And it's about Jamaica and, you know, what they went through several years ago in terms of the World Trade Organization forcing them, mm-hmm, to allow outside products, you know, like, mm, milk and vegetables and so forth, and how it totally destroyed their nascent
their
industry.
Their own local economy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if we were really that concerned about the third world, we'd have programs to help them develop their industry,
right,
and
right,
allow them a little bit of latitude, you know.
Right.
So,
yeah. Well, getting back to the right to peaceful assembly and associations, just recently Amnesty International has published some real concerns. And the first one was, what's the date today? This is yesterday, I think.
28th.
This 28th? Is the 28th,
this was yesterday, January 27th. Some of you may have heard of the Tunisian security forces and the brutality that they were using even yesterday on, let's see, protesters. There have been protesters in Tunisia. There have been security forces used in a disproportionate level, firing on fleeing protesters and bystanders. Amnesty International research team showed that some protesters were shot from behind, indicating they were fleeing. Others in other cities, because this was going all over the country in different cities, were killed by single shots to the chest or the head, suggesting deliberate intent to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And the shocking evidence confirms that Tunisian security forces were using lethal methods to quell discontent and to deter protesters. The fact that some of those killed were clearly running away shows flagrant disregard for the people's lives. Once again, we get back to the right to peaceful assembly and peaceful, mm-hmm, association. And the day before yesterday, there was Amnesty published a real concern about Egypt as well. There has been a lot of peaceful protesting in Egypt. And Amnesty is condemning a crackdown once again on demonstrations amid continuing protests against. And this goes back to what you were talking about, David. We don't know what's really going on out there.
Mm-hmm.
These people were protesting against poverty, police abuse, and corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And in turn, the government's using the police to, mm-hmm, crack down on them and to prevent,
right,
them from doing that. A lot of this happened in Cairo and Alexandria and some other major cities. There were at least 3 deaths. Rubber bullets, tear gas employed against the crowds, beating of detainees, and at least 500 protesters arrested. We witnessed reckless policing yesterday with the security forces relying on tear gas and using rubber bullets. And this was the statement by the deputy director for the Middle East and North Africa program. Demonstrators started peacefully, but then they started throwing stones, and scuffles broke out when the security forces started forcibly dispersing demonstrators.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we have this legal right, international right, to peacefully protest and to demonstrate, and it's not happening. We're not allowed. You know, governments aren't allowing us to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And what really concerns me is coming in and pushing at the protesters and the protesters responding with sticks and stones, which basically happened at the G20. You know, if anything did happen, it was a stick that broke a window. And then they come in with their guns blazing, so to speak,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, their horses and their batons, and there were rubber bullets at the G20.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge issue for me. And I think it should be for all of us who want the right to protest peacefully and let our government know what we're looking for. So is it about wrap up time?
We're getting there.
Jim's giving me the eye here.
We got a little over a minute.
Okay.
Well, Donna and I, you know, I guess it's in our blood, but we were in Seattle, you know, protesting at the WGO.
Right on.
And WTO.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a beautiful, peaceful demonstration. Thousands of people, you know, and it gives you a good feeling of solidarity.
Right.
But then, you know, there are the so-called anarchists that come and, you know, break windows and so forth.
Right.
And unfortunately, the media, you know, concentrates on them and gives you the picture. So
Same
we
thing.
Were staying with some friends in Seattle, and they were saying, well, you know, what's wrong? You know, this is terrible. Well, we said they didn't show the you know, the mass of us that were just peacefully demonstrating.
Right,
you know,
right. And the message is not getting out.
Right.
Thankfully, the message got out in 1963.
And we're out of time.
We're out of time. Thank you, David Cowley, for being on our show. It was a pleasure to have you and to hear you,
thank you.
Talk
thank
about
you.
Your life experiences.
Right.
Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said it's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness.